With this audience, I don't really need to tell you what frameworks are, but just to set things up, I'm going to be looking at bar joint frameworks, and all my bar joint frameworks are in the plane, so nothing I talk about will deal with higher dimensions, and, you know, we all know what it means to be rigid, and we know what it means to be flexible. But this talk is, in some sense, really a combinatorics talk, so I'm just going to work in the plane, and so we have, for generic frameworks, the Lamon theory, where rigidity and flexibility are combinatorial properties. So, in particular, if it's minimally rigid, then the underlying graph is a Lamon graph, and vice versa for generic realizations. So, for this talk, also just to fix some terminology, subgraphs that have as a spanning subgraph a Lamon graph, I'm just going to call them rigid blocks. But I'm not going to insist that they be independent in the Lamon sense. So that's a rigid block, this is a rigid block, and notice also that any single edges are rigid blocks. So the intuition behind what I'm going to say comes from considering the following sort of random process that I'll describe loosely. So we start with, say, a fixed number n generic points in the plane, and then maybe uniformly at random, I don't know how you can illustrate this in a picture, but I just start throwing in bars into my framework or just edges into my graph. And over time, eventually, rigid blocks will form. So, you know, for example, this triangle, or maybe this larger subgraph. But the whole thing, you know, won't be rigid for quite some time. And if you do this for a much larger example, so this drawing is not intended to show any geometric configuration. I just drew it with a graph drawing tool. But what I did here was I started with a large number of points, I think about 1,000, and I just threw in edges of the graph. And as I went, I computed the maximal rigid blocks, the rigid components. And the color coding says the following. If an edge is gray, then the maximal rigid block that it's in is just that edge itself. If an edge is blue, then the biggest rigid subgraph that it's part of is a triangle. And notice that at this point, although there seem to be quite a few edges and it's a rather messy picture, every edge in this picture is gray or blue, and there's even some isolated vertices floating off at the top and the bottom of the picture. And now I'm going to add just one more edge. And somehow the picture turns pink. So what did it mean to turn pink? Well, when I added this one edge, and maybe you can see it and maybe you can't, but I drew it as green as an illustration, a very large rigid component formed in this graph. So the pink edges are all one now very large rigid component, and still there are a bunch of gray ones and even one triangle. So these are edges that are still in rigid blocks that are only edges or triangles. And so, in other words, at some point in this process, the change was extremely dramatic. They got swallowed in the pink part. The pink blob oozed and ate them. I just put the vertices that way. I mean, this isn't a generic point set, it's just a graph. So, because some vertices never got any edge at this point.
No.
Oh, like these. Yeah, because I made this graph by just randomly threw edges in, and it just so happened that as I was going along, I never had an edge hit, say, this vertex down here. Oh, yeah, these are also vertices of the graph. The answer is I used an automated drawing tool because I didn't know how to place 1,000 points in any convenient way, and if you place them at random in the square, then it gets sort of too horrible, and you have many isolated vertices in the middle, and so it's more of an illustrative schematic than a geometric picture. So, so sort of more formally, what I'm going to work in is what's called the Erdős-Rényi random graph model, and a random graph is not really a graph. A random graph is really a distribution over graphs, and so the sort of simplest and probably best studied model is this Erdős-Rényi model, where you start with a fixed number of vertices and you fix a probability, And then for every edge, you flip a coin. And if it comes up heads, the edge is in. If not, the edge is out. And the kind of statement that I'm interested in is a sort of with high probability statement, as it's called in the trade. So in particular, a statement like the probability that there's a big component is 1 minus little o of 1 as n grows. So a kind of question that you could ask is, you know, how many random edges do I need before a big component appears? And so what I'm really going to say is that I'm working in a GNP where I have n, and then the probability is some fixed constant c divided by n, so a graph that has constant average degree. And you could ask other questions like structural ones. How many big components will you have? And, you know, how big will the big components be? And so when I say components, I mean rigid components, not connected components. So for this crowd, maybe the slight abusive word is not so horrible, but I mean rigid component. So to not keep you too much in suspense, I'll give you a relatively complete answer. So there's a magic number, 3.588, that is really the root of a transcendental equation. And this magic number has the property that whenever this average degree C is strictly greater than that, there is a linear-sized rigid component. So in other words, there's a very large rigid component. How many? There's just one above the threshold. On the other hand, if you take the average degree strictly less than this magic threshold constant, then all the rigid components, the maximal blocks, are just vertices, edges, and some triangles. So really, the picture that you should have in mind is that transition from gray to pink. This is what's going on. And then, how big? Well, I can say that it has a structural property. This giant rigid component spans nearly all of what I will call the 3 plus 2 core. And what that is that graphs in this range have what's called the 3 core, which is an induced subgraph of minimum degree 3, and you take the largest one, and that's called the 3 core. And then, because we're dealing in rigidity, if something has two neighbors in the 3 core, if you imagine the 3 core as having been rigid, then that would also be as part of a larger rigid block, and you could, of course, do this inductively. And so this maximal structure is what I'll call the 3 plus 2 core. And so as n gets large, the 3 plus 2 core gets swallowed by this large rigid component. But if you're below, you get nothing at all. So some commentary on what this means. Well, when you're dealing with these sparse GNPs, with high probability, there will always be isolated vertices, like this one, and also leaves, like this one. So with this few edges in your random graph, you have really no hope for, say, the whole thing to be rigid, because that would require minimum degree 2, for example. And that happens with many more edges in a random, random graph. So it also doesn't have any induced subgraph of minimum degree 4 with high probability. So this is what's, you know, known as the 4 core, and this number 3.588 is below the threshold for that. And then by linear size, well, the 3 core, its size is known with high probability pretty much exactly, and it would be around 30% of the whole graph. The 3 plus 2 core is quite a bit larger. Maybe at the end I can talk about how large I think it is, which is around 75%, but proving that requires some tools that we don't have, so it's a conjecture. So, well, where does this come from? So the statistical physics community has looked at problems like this a lot because they're interested in phase transitions of network glasses. And Rivoire and Barr did some simulations, and they noticed that an explosive growth of a rigid component in the 3 core at 1.749 n edges in that random graph process I described, which, notice that this is half of 3.588, so the magic number had been observed. And there's a lot of other work in the statistical physics community. McCarzel, you know, Mike Thorpe, and Don Jacobs and Mike Thorpe. I've sort of called out this one because they worked on this exact problem, these kind of GNPs. So there's also work of rigidity in random graphs. So Jackson, Servadius, and Servadius looked at, well, they proved that a random four regular graph, which is more structured than what I talked about, is globally rigid with high probability. So they have a better rigidity result. On the other hand, their degree sequence of the graph is a bit more constrained. And also, they tell you what the threshold is for the whole thing to be rigid. And this is really controlled by essentially the point where minimum degree becomes 2. Right? So it's roughly, I mean, it's really a coupon collector's thing. So it's like, you know, log n plus 2 log log n plus little omega of 1 over n, something like this. And then I previously had just showed that in these sparse GNPs that, you know, the typical case is that all rigid components are either tiny, 1, 2, or 3 vertices, or giant, linear sized. And this you can do with counting arguments. So there's also, and this is going to be a key tool, related work on random graphs. So in particular, a few years ago in SOTA, there were 2 papers, Fernholz Ramachandran and Kane Sanders Vormald, that looked at a question called 2 orientability. And so they were interested in, when does a random graph have an orientation so that every vertex gets out degree at most 2? And this same exact constant is the 2 orientability threshold. And it's also the threshold where the 3 core reaches average degree 4. So in some sense, this rigid component emerges at the first time any subgraph gets dense enough to have about 2n minus 3 edges in the first place. So a better way of thinking about 2 orientability, and the one that is more familiar to rigidity theorists, is that it means that it's 2-0 sparse. So a graph is 2 orientable when, if you have a subgraph with m prime edges, the, you know, or n prime vertices, the number of edges is at most m prime for all subgraphs. And it's worth noting that if you have a large rigid component with high probability, then adding only a constant number of random edges blocks 2 orientability with probability bounded from 0. So in particular, you can read out of Fernholz and Ramachandran that below this threshold, the rigid components are all small. That's sort of the easy direction of the theorem. And so the basic intuition is that with enough randomness around, as soon as you get enough edges for something to be potentially a rigid subgraph, it will be very likely. So the main kind of technical result you need to actually prove that is what happens when you go above this 2 orientability threshold. So none of the papers establishing the threshold for 2 orientability say what happens when C goes above 3.588. So in particular, you know that, well, it's not possible to give every vertex out degree 0, 1, or 2, but maybe now it's possible to get, like, almost every vertex exactly 2. Can't tell. So this has to be proved, and that's a kind of secondary technical theorem, that when you go above the 2 orientability threshold, then with high probability, almost all of the 3 core can be given out degree at least 2. And this, of course, implies the same for that 3 plus 2 core I was talking about. Because, after all, if you have a degree 2 vertex, just orient its edges out, tick it off. Okay, so maybe I'll... When did I start? So maybe I'll indicate some of the basic ideas. So let's remind ourselves of some standard facts about rigid blocks and components, Lamont rigid blocks and components and graphs. So maybe the first observation is that if G has, you know, at least 2n minus 3 edges, and it isn't actually a Lamont graph, then it has what's known as a Lamont circuit. And if it's simple, this means that it has a smaller rigid block on at least 4 vertices, and that has minimum degree 3. So this is a very two-dimensional statement. As people have discussed in 3 dimensions, these circuits, they don't need to be rigid. They don't need to be rigid components don't need to be induced. So another fact is that if you have a rigid block and you add something with 2 neighbors in it, you get a bigger rigid block. And if you have 2 rigid blocks and you add 3 edges between them that are not all incident on 1 vertex, you get a bigger rigid block. So with this, you get a relatively simple lemma that if a graph is, say, equal to its own 3 plus 2 core, and it has some rigid component, so maybe I'll draw a schematic picture. So if you have some graph, say, this is a rigid component, this is the rest. And say that this has N1 vertices, this has N2. So then you have some stuff maybe going in between and some stuff in here. And the statement is that, well, you may as well assume this rigid component is actually a Lamont graph. So it has 2 and 1 minus 3. And if you further assume that this part here is incident on 2 and 2 edges, then either the entire thing has a spanning Lamont subgraph, or somewhere there's a rigid block that is not this one. And that just comes from the fact that if it's not a spanning Lamont subgraph, there's a circuit somewhere. And if you assume it's not here, it exists outside of it. So, like I say, the point is you can't avoid sort of rigidity or multiple rigid components. Okay? So, with this, maybe we'll revisit the four regular case and try to derive an admittedly harder proof than Jackson, Servadius, and Servadius used. So, the first trick is exploit sort of density. So, remember that these sparse random graphs, including four regular ones, they don't have small subgraphs that have more edges than vertices. So since rigid components have that property, provided they are not triangles or smaller, this says that the rigid components that are there would be with high probability either huge or tiny. So let's assume that they're huge because we know they're there. There are, you know, n vertices and 2n edges. But now we use the second trick, which is that there's a lot of randomness running around here. So if you have two huge rigid components, the probability that all of the edges did not go between them, right? We only need three. And if you think of this as, you know, n and this is n, there are like n squared possibilities. So this is quite unlikely. So you get two big components with very small probability, and therefore with high probability, the whole thing is at least rigid. Don't globally rigid, I don't know. This argument is weaker. So, but if we want to, the good thing about this proof is it generalizes to when it's not four regular. So, you know, let's fix C above our threshold and just assume for the moment that this three core has an out degree at least two orientation. So now we'll look more deeply in the three core. It has average degree at least 4. And since we assumed that it had this out degree at least 2 orientation, that combinatorial lemma applied. And so now, again, there would be a giant rigid component in it. It would be unique by essentially the same argument. And that would tell you that 3 plus 2 core was, in fact, rigid in the first place. There was a spanning Lamont graph. So now you have to put it together. So, of course, we don't know that we could get that out degree at least 2 orientation for the 3 core, but we're very close. So, you know, maybe around root n or so edges. In the paper, we give some estimates, but they're not made to be sharp. But you could take this to be, say, root n times log cubed n. Vertices don't have out degree 2, but you can add a small number of edges uniformly at random, which is fine for these kind of asymptotic statements. And now the lemma applies to the original 3 plus 2 core. And there's a technical step, but it just says that the 3 plus 2 core here does not grow explosively when C is this large. And it doesn't because the derivatives of the 3 core are controlled sort of at all derivatives. So what that tells you is that you get almost all of the new 3 plus 2 core. So this sort of indicates the idea of, well, how you reduce this theorem about a rigidity transition to an orientability transition. So maybe, how much time do I have left? I don't quite know where I started. Good, perfect. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about how you prove this orientability theorem, because the techniques here are a little bit outside sort of the standard rigidity graph theory. So GNPs are great because they're always simple and they're sort of very natural, but they can be hard to work with. So another kind of random graph is called a configuration, which is really a random multigraph, but they end up being simple with probability greater than zero, so things that are true of these configurations are also true of GNPs with the same average degree. So how do you make what's called a random configuration? Well, you start with some vertices, which I'll sort of think of as these large circles, and for each of them, I pick, according to some probability distribution, a degree. So I decide in advance what the degree of every vertex will be, randomly, but I don't say what the edges are. Then I generate a uniform matching of these smaller vertices, of these smaller circles. So the smaller circles are meant to say, well, this one will have degree 2 at the end, you know, and this one will have degree 3, and also this one. So you start matching them up, and when everything is all matched up, this is what's called a random configuration. Of course, it can give you a multigraph, it can give you loops, but it has been shown that with probability bounded away from zero, you don't have any of this, so you can transfer results back onto simple random graphs. And so what degree sequence would you pick to get one of the sparse GNPs? Well, you'd pick Poisson with mean C, right? Sort of the limiting case of a sparse binomial. And so notice that there was a lot of looseness in this configuration idea. So you can match up these vertex copies, the, you know, sort of edge endpoints, with any algorithm that gives you a uniform matching. And so when they were looking at two-orientability, Fernholz and Ramachandran defined two moves, right? So it was a kind of iterative algorithmic process. So they would generate the degrees. And so one of the moves was, well, if you have some copy with very few vertices, I guess my slide doesn't have the picture here, so I'll just draw it. So you've got here some vertex, and you know that it will have two edges coming out of it. So what do you do? Well, you say, okay, so you just take this one out, right? And then there's many other things here, and there's some endpoints here. And well, you sample one uniformly at random, you draw the edge there. Then you sample another one uniformly at random, and you draw the edge there. Recursively generate something uniform on the rest, and this is uniform. But so the other thing that they have is, let's just assume that the minimum degree is 3 for the moment. So what they say is, well, take a going to be degree 3 vertex, it's not matched up yet, so take it out and just remove one other vertex copy uniformly at random. Now generate the rest of the matching, and once you know what the matching is, sample an edge from that uniformly and split it, right? So the idea is, well, okay, so you pick this black thing, you know, this mate was picked uniformly at random, you hold these two in your pocket for the moment, generate the rest, and then you maybe pick an edge uniformly at random like this one, and you split it. So for rigidity people, you've seen this already. So this is just Henneberg 1 and 2. So really, in these two orientability proofs, what they were studying is essentially trying to eat the random graph back to nothing with Henneberg 1 and 2. And of course, if you can do that, then your graph was 2-0 sparse in the first place. So there's even a nice rigidity theoretic interpretation. So what do we do? Well, we want to find orientations. So essentially, we're going to just play this game and try to orient the edges as we go. So we have this configuration, and if the minimum degree is at most 2, just grab a low degree vertex, orient both of its edges coming out, pick off two mates uniformly at random, and proceed. So if the minimum degree is 3, then we do exactly what I said. We take it out, we take one copy out, and just go, because we don't need to know really what the graph is, we just need to know that we'll succeed. And if the minimum degree that's left is 4, you can just say you're done for other reasons. So, and then you just run this until there's some little O of n vertices left. Root n is fine. If you just want soft results, you can even pick your favorite small constant and do it for any constant. So basically, the only thing left to analyze is, well, when does this fail? So notice that, so what we do is we just divide this up into what we call rounds. So when the minimum degree is 3, you start by doing one of these degree 3 moves, and a priori you know that this will have out degree 2, right? But then this is a dynamic process. So you remove something at random, and that might create a degree 2 vertex. So then now you're starting to do degree 2 moves, and each time you're sort of picking off one or two copies uniformly at random. So you can fail to get a good orientation at a vertex when, say, it started as degree 3 and somehow it got hit 2 times. So there are really, you can either be hit twice in a round or it had degree 2 and it was hit at random. Either one of these will give you a loose vertex. But these are relatively low probability events at any particular step because you assume there are a lot of vertices on this graph. So really the important thing is how long these rounds go. So if the minimum degree rises to 3 again relatively quickly, then the number of vertices that could have become loose, well, they all have to be processed before the minimum degree rises to 3, and that happens with probability, you know, say 1 over root n. So if all the rounds are very short, say log n, then you get exactly what you want, no loose vertices. And so that happens to be true. This is the key technical result, is that the minimum degree comes back to 3 relatively fast. It looks like a branching process with, you know, subcritical expected number of children. So after O of log n vertices, rounds end, and that gives you the bound. So I should be just about out of time. And so maybe I'll just leave some questions here. So the first is a conjecture, which is that the actual size of this 3 plus 2 core, and thus the actual size of the big rigid component, should be around 75%. So in particular, a kind of heuristic is that it should be a fixed point of that equation. So, you know, but the problem is that this is hard to prove. The same methods we used of these peeling things don't quite work, and if you want to know, I'll tell you offline. So the other thing is that the analysis is clean, but it's not particularly tight. We didn't really winch it down that much, so maybe you have really only a constant number of vertices in the 3 core that don't get out degree 2. And then you could ask about, you know, other families of random graphs, global rigidity, and questions such as this. So here, I'll wrap it up.